Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the podcasts that are living over there. You can check out that new Hidden Streams podcast featuring Chad Bird. We put a little clip of that podcast at the end of our last episode. If you didn't listen to that, you should go check it out. Or just, you know, go over to the whatever podcasting app or platform you use and search Hidden Streams and check out the new devotional kind of In the Psalms podcast featuring Chad Bird. It's got original music. It's probably one of the most highly produced podcasts that we have. I mean, it's not like me and Chad just sitting here chopping it up. It ain't like that. There's a lot of production that goes into this bad boy. So check that out. I think that you will probably enjoy it. Also, if you are in the Las Vegas area or anywhere in Nevada, or maybe you're in Arizona or Southern California, come on out to the city event that we're having in Las Vegas on March 21st. I'll be there, and Eric Sorensen and Scott Keith and Blake Flatley, Cindy Koch, and Adam Francisco, we're going to go through the entire book of Galatians. Yeah, it's going to be a cool thing, man. You're going to be able to come out. We're going to read the entire book in the course of the day and talk about it. And so it's don't get all freaked out. It's not that long of a book. I know you hear we're going to read a whole book, and you know that seems like a lot. It's not a lot. What you're going to learn is that you can read the book of Galatians in one day, no problem. And not only read it, but actually hear a lot about it. So come check that out. I'll put a link in the show notes, or you can go over to the events page, get all the information there. It's free. All you got to do is sign up and show up, you know, have some lunch with us. It's going to be a good time. Also, Germany, Sweden, we're heading out. We're going to hit the trail, go out there in Europe. We are going to be in Germany the first weekend of May and in Sweden the second weekend of May, talking about Christian freedom. Chad and I, just right before this, we're talking about the things we were going to talk about. I think it's going to be a good time. So I'll put a link in the show notes to the registration for both those events. If you are in Sweden or Germany or anywhere in Europe where you can get over to those places, come on out. We'd love to hang out with you. All right, Chad, what is going on, man? We left Gideon in an interesting place where he's just breathing all kinds of threats.
Yeah, man, what happened to him?
He got all confident, man. He had a resounding victory, and he is just telling everyone exactly what he's going to do.
Yeah, he did. He did. I mean, when we first meet him, he's like, oh, I don't know, man. I'm like, I'm the youngest. My clan, they're like small clan. I think you have to find somebody else. And the angel finally gets him to do it after like giving him 15 signs that he's going to be with him. And so he finally gets his victory, and he's like, whoa, man, this is a new guy. Yeah. All of a sudden, yeah, he's like bossing people around, making threats. Like, he got a taste of blood. Now he's out for more.
Yeah, well, he had a victory using unlikely means, you know, torches and clay pots and this sort of stuff. So now he's like, man, I like this unconventional means thing. So when I get back here, I'm going to take some briars and some thorns and just go to town on some people.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of where we left him, breathing these threats against these folks. Yeah, they're on the run. They're on the trail of people who are on the run. So they caught some of these Midianite guys. Orev and Zeev are the two. We got a lot of Z names in here. So they took them out, beheaded them, actually. But they're chasing these Midianites. And I can't give it away now. Maybe you know the story already. If you've read this whole chapter, but I'm not going to give it away now, but there's a reason I think that Gideon is hot on the heels of the Midianites. And the thing is, we haven't yet been told. It's like one of these details that is withheld until later in the story. So we really don't know. I mean, at this point it's like, wow. I mean, he's chasing them. I mean, it'd be one thing to do battle against them on their side of the Jordan, on Gideon's side of the Jordan. But he like crosses the river and he's going way, way into the wilderness to try and find these guys. I mean, he is not going to stop until he catches them. You think he just like, okay, we drove them out. We killed a bunch of their guys. Let's go home, enjoy the spoils of war, enjoy our freedom, and declare the victory. But that's not the way it works. So they're on the way, and they've been gone a while because they're real hungry. So they stop at this Israelite village called Sukkot. And that's where we have the hangry moment, right? They won't feed him. And so he says, all right, I'll tell you what, when you come back, I'm going to whip you with briars and thorns. That's kind of where we're left off. That's verse 7 of Judges 8. And right after that, he utters another threat. So I guess he goes from there to the next place, a place called Penuel. And kind of the same thing happened. These guys wouldn't give him any provisions because they didn't have any evidence of this success yet. So he says to them, when I return safely, I will tear down this tower. So the first place, he's going to take some thorns of the wilderness and some briars and thrash the bodies of the men who wouldn't help him at Sukkot. He's going to tear down the tower in Penuel. So he's got a plan of revenge coming up. So I guess we'll have to wait and see what happens. As it turns out, he's going to do a little more than he threatened. But anyway, that's where we're at. So that took us through verse 9 of Judges 8. So let's find out what goes on next in this hot game of hot pursuit. It says, Zebah and Zalmunna, those are the Midianite kings, Z and Z, they were in a place called Karkor, which is about, I mean, this kind of gives you an idea as to how far he's gone. That's about 100 miles. If the people who have located it are correct, there's always a little bit of an iffiness to some of these geographical locations. But most people think that Karkor is 100 miles east of the Dead Sea. Now, keep in mind, we started out a few miles west of the Sea of Galilee. And now we've ended up 100 miles into the wilderness on the eastern side of the Dead Sea. That's a long, long way to be pursuing these kings. But that's where they stop. It says their armies are with them, about 15,000 men. And that's all that was left of that whole army. It says they're, the guys who died were 120,000. So they're down to a pretty small force now after the whole slaughter that took place on the night of trumpets and torches and clay jars. It says Gideon, verse 11, Gideon went up by the way of those who lived in the tents, so some kind of caravan route evidently, on the east of a couple of places called Novah and Jogbaha. And it says he attacked the camp when the camp was unsuspecting, or when they felt secure, is another way that Hebrew is translated there. So they, in other words, they think, man, we're in Karkor, we're 100 miles east of the Dead Sea. We're way, way out of the range of the Israelites. So they think they're back in their own territory. They think everything's going to be fine. So Gideon does a surprise attack. And it says the kings once again got away. So he pursues them. And he finally catches them after he's routed the whole army. By the way, that word routed, the Hebrew there is charad. That's the same verb that we encountered way back at the beginning of chapter 3. They camped by the spring of Harad. And the first group that was sent home of Gideon's army were those who were afraid and were charading. So it's this image of trembling. My translation has, they routed the whole army. But whatever they did to them, they shook them up, maybe we'd say. So they shook up the whole army. They were shaking, they were quivering. Whatever they did exactly, we know that it was a success. But the two kings get away. So Gideon, once more, he's going to chase these guys down and capture them. And it says that he went back. And he's still, the strange part about this story is he didn't kill the kings, the prisoners of war. And he's going to take care of them momentarily, but it's like he can't wait to get back to Sukkot and to deal with the people that wouldn't take care of his army by giving them provisions. So they go back to Sukkot, and he's going to find a way to get into the city. We don't know exactly what happened. Maybe they saw him coming and they closed the gates of the city, whatever it was. They weren't able to just march into Sukkot and take the city. So what they do is they catch this young guy. He's described as a youth from Sukkot. And they interrogate him. And they get him to write down all the princes of Sukkot. It turns out there's 77 men there. These were probably just, the translation is princes. I mean, it's probably just kind of the local leaders, right? I mean, they're just the guys who were I don't know what we compare it to, like the town council. I mean, these were just kind of the, maybe the elders of the city is another way of thinking about this. So anyway, there's 77 of these guys, and Gideon wants their names because, of course, he has plans for these guys. So there's 77 of them. This kid that they caught writes it down for him. He comes to the men of Sukkot. And of course, when he showed up there the first time, they're like, we're not going to give you any bread because we don't see you already having these two Midianite kings. So we're not going to take care of you. So he says to them, look, Zebah and Zalmunna, concerning whom you taunted me, saying, are the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna already in your hand that we should give bread to your men who are weary? So he throws the words right back in their face. And now he actually has in his hands these two particular kings. And what do you think he's going to do to them? he's gonna follow through, right? Verse 16, he takes the elders of the city, and he takes thorns of the wilderness and briars, and this is my translation, says he disciplined the men of Sukkot with them. Is that what you have?
No, I've got a better translation than that.
What do you have?
My translation straight up says, and he took the elders of the city and took thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Sukkoth a lesson.
That's great. Taught them a lesson. I when I saw that discipline, I thought, what's the Hebrew there? So I looked it up, and it's interesting. It's the verb for to make know, you know, yada.
It's instruction.
Yeah, it's like he made the men of Sukkot know by using these briars. So, you know, we often hear that knowing in the Hebrew scriptures isn't just a mental activity, but it's an experiential sort of thing.
Yeah.
So there's all sorts of experiences, right? Adam knew his wife Eve and she conceived. Well, that's one kind of knowing. Gideon made the men of Sukkot know by the use of briars and thorns. And that's quite a different kind of not so pleasant knowing. But that's what he followed through with. Now he's on the warpath. He's caught these two kings. He's gone back to Sukkot. He's thrown their words right back in their face. They taunted him. He taunts them. And so he takes these 77 princes of Sukkot and he disciplines them. He teaches them a lesson, which is, you know, when you step back from this story, back from the details, and you think of everything we've learned about Gideon from the very beginning, it's like we are dealing with a completely different person here.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, when we meet him, he's threshing. But he's not like, he doesn't have people laying on the ground threshing them with briars and thorns. He's threshing wheat hidden inside a wine vat. Yeah.
You know, sometimes these stories move very quickly and you can be like, man, seems extreme. But yeah, you have to realize that you are talking about a group of people overthrowing another group of people that is horrifically oppressing them.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't like just randomly rolling up on some some people, and then they refuse to give you some food, and then you go off on them. You're talking about the children of Israel having been, enslaved essentially, or at least dominated by this other group of people.
Yeah, yeah. So it's pretty severe, but yeah, when you look at it in the bigger story, it makes a little more sense. But he's not done yet, because right, he's taking care of Sukkot. But look at the next verse, verse 17. When he was at Penuel earlier, what did he say? He said, when I come back, I'm going to tear down your tower. Well, he does that. It says, verse 17, and he tore down the tower of Penuel, but he ain't done. Because it says he goes on and he kills the men of the city. So it's like the more he does, the greater the next thing has to be, right? So he whips the men of Sukkot, and he threatened to tear down the tower of Penuel, but he doesn't do just that. He actually executes all the men of the city as well. So all this he does, and he still has the two kings with him. Now, I'm thinking these two kings, assuming they observed all this, are probably thinking, man, what in the world does he have planned for us?
Yeah, this, I got to tell you, Chad, this seems rather personal.
Yes, it does seem rather personal. And I think we're about to find out why. So this is the moment at which, once we find out this detail, and if you didn't know it already, you're about to hear it. This is the moment where, once you find out this particular fact, it makes you go back and reread the whole story from a different perspective. The Bible does this sometimes, not always with every story, but on occasion, it's kind of a, I don't know what the technical literary device is called, but it's a literary device where it's kind of like, what can I compare it with? It's kind of like when you're reading a mystery novel, all right? And you get to the last chapter and you find out what it was all about, you know, who did it or whatever it is disclosed in that final chapter. What do you do? Well, typically you, in your mind, you just kind of run back through the whole story and you're kind of putting pieces together and you're understanding the whole story a little bit better once you know how everything kind of fits together at the end. Well, that's kind of what's going to happen here, because verse 18, it says that Gideon spoke to these two kings and says, "What kind of men were they whom you killed at Tabor?" Now, this just strikes us out of the blue, because Tabor has not been mentioned once in this whole story. Even from the very beginning, there's been no mention whatsoever of Tabor. And the guys respond, the kings respond, "They were like you, each one resembling the son of a king." Now, we don't know if they mean that like facetiously or if this is like they're actually being honest here. And Gideon had some sort of regal look about him. Really don't know. But whatever it was, that's the way they respond. Now, here's the moment, verse 19. Gideon says, "They were my brothers, the sons of my mother. As the Lord lives, if only you had let them live, I would not kill you." So this is the moment where you're like, oh, now a lot of this is beginning to make sense. You see, it was one thing for God to call Gideon and to clothe him with his spirit and to send him out to save Israel, and in the process, of course, to defeat the Midianite kings. It was quite another thing for Gideon not only to do this, but to pursue them hundreds of miles into the wilderness, and along the way, to just completely blow up at these two towns of Succoth and Penuel, not only to issue the threats, but to make sure that he brought these two kings back and to deliver on those threats. This was not so much about Gideon seeking faithfully to fulfill his vocation as the deliverer for Israel, as it was about him seeking blood vengeance for the death of his brothers.
Yeah.
That's what I think is crucial here.
Yeah. And you have a distinction too, because he says they were my brothers. Now, if that was all it said, this could be interpreted as they were fellow Israelites, right? I mean, they could be from the same tribe as Gideon, and that they would use that brother language then as well. But it's more distinct than that. So I might say Chad's my brother, and this would be correct. In the way that Christians talk, so Chad and I are brothers in Christ, and that's how that works. So I could say, "Hey, you have gravely offended my brother, and thus you've offended me," that kind of thing. But that's different if I say you've gravely offended my brother, who is also the son of my mother. Now we're talking about like my actual flesh and blood brother at this point. So this is not just, "Hey, you killed some Israelites, and I regard Israelites as my brothers." But you have killed my actual family.
Yeah, yeah. That's why this causes us to go back at least a chapter or chapter and a half and begin to read this story in a whole new light. And I think it helps us then to understand exactly why Gideon is acting the way he does. Of course, that initial victory probably did go to his head a little bit. It was a greater victory than he ever expected. But I think something else was going on here, and something that was more influential, and that was this desire to seek revenge for the death of his brothers. It could, I don't know for sure, but it could partially explain why God chose Gideon to begin with. I mean, that's conjecture on my part. Maybe because he knew that Gideon having lost brothers to the Midianites would, once he had a little prompting and, you know, two or three divine miracles, be ready to act as Israel's deliverer. But anyway, whatever was kind of behind his motivations, I think we can definitively say that the reason we see a new Gideon, one who's grown fangs, as it were, in these last few stories, is because he's looking for blood revenge against the Midianites for the sake of his brothers.
Yeah, and how he carries this out is interesting too.
It is, yeah. I mean, you would think he'd gone this far, he would just do it, right? But he doesn't. First, he says to his firstborn, so this is his oldest son. We'll hear about his other sons at the close of this chapter. But this is his oldest son, who's named Jether. And he says to him, "Rise, kill them." He says, but the youth did not draw his sword because he was afraid, because he was still a youth. Now, there's an irony there, because you remember when we first encountered Gideon that he was like that, right? So it's like his son is sort of an image of the pre-Gideon, if you will, at least the Gideon who was before the Gideon that we're facing now. So he's afraid. He don't want to do it, but he wants his firstborn to do it. So it's kind of a family thing, I suppose. Take revenge for the sake of your uncles, kind of thing.
Yeah, I think this is the first moment that we're given the information that Gideon even has sons.
Yeah, it is, right.
And
right.
And this kind of paints with some different colors too, because if God is asking you to do this crazy thing and you've got a family, this is different. If I think that you're like, well, there's this guy, Gideon, and immediately I think that we think, and I do, that, okay, well, this is probably like a young guy.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to go in there, and you know, he's probably at the in the prime of life, ready to go in there and, you know, take some guys out. And now we find that Gideon has sons, and that these sons are old enough to be in battle with him and stuff. So this means that Gideon is not that young of a guy.
Yeah, I remember when first looking at this story, I thought, yeah, Gideon's probably, I don't know, what, 20?
Yeah.
At 25. I mean, because he describes himself as, what did he say? He says, "I am the youngest in my father's house."
Yeah.
So when you hear that, you mean, oh, okay. So he's, you know, he's 18, 19, 20 years old, whatever, yeah, maybe 25.
You think he's a David.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You think he's at least like a David, like a teenager out there. Well, no. I mean, he's old enough to have, not only just old enough to have a son, but old enough to have a son who is old enough to travel hundreds of miles with his army while they are chasing the Midianite kings. So we're filling out the picture a little bit more as we go along of who Gideon was. Well, then we have another surprise, because these two kings are observing this, right? They know. I mean, there cannot be any doubt in their minds that they're going to die. They've seen what he did to those two cities, and he just told his firstborn to kill them. So they know they're going to die. So they kind of have this last minute courage, right? They say to Gideon, "Rise up yourself and fall on us. For as the man, so is his strength." So kind of one of these proverbial sort of sayings. So in other words, if you're going to do it, well, then why don't you do it, right? Why are you trying to get somebody else to do your dirty work for you? Rise up and do it yourself. So he did. Gideon arose, killed Zebah and Zalmunna. And little detail here at the end that's going to prove very significant for the rest of the chapter and for Gideon's legacy. He not only killed them, but he said he took the crescent ornaments, which were on their camels' necks. We'll get back to that in a moment. So that takes care of the Midianite kings. And Gideon is victorious. He's just taken revenge against the guys that, as we found out, killed his brothers. And so we might think, well, story's about over, right? The next couple of verses are going to say, and the land had rest for 40 years, and Gideon died and slept with his fathers. End of chapter, right?
Yeah, that would be nice.
It would be nice. But as I said, when I mentioned the crescent ornaments, that's significant, because as we're about to find out, the end of Gideon's life did not go well. We see this so often in the scriptures, And we see this so often in just today's world as well, how victory or great achievements or fabulous successes, even though these are an opportunity for the accomplishing of more great good, very often, if not more often than not, actually provide an opportunity of temptation to come in and to lead to whoever that is who's been successful or triumphant into great harm and vice and other great sorts of sin. I mean, you see this all over the Judges. I mean, all over the stories of the kings, right? You know, a king starts out great, and then by the end of his life, it all goes to his head, and he ends up glorifying himself instead of glorifying God. That seemed to be so integral to human nature that it is proverbial. I mean, it's just all over and over again, we see examples of this, and as we're about to see, it happens to Gideon as well.
Yeah, another thing that's interesting that we see right before that, we haven't got into this yet, but we're about to, is that the men of Israel are going to be like, you know, this is sort of one of the first instances where you sort of see this desire, not necessarily, they don't say the word outright king, but a desire to, like, you know what, maybe like a singular person in charge of everything would be a good idea, because this sort of things are good, then we're oppressed, and then things are good, and then we're oppressed is bad. And if there was ever a moment where maybe we could identify someone to be the guy in charge, this seems like a good moment to do this.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're wanting to kind of break this chain, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you can't wrap your head around why someone would think this, I mean, I would be probably there right with him. Like, you know, it'd be a good idea. Let's just like have this guy lead us from now on, and yeah, that'll probably be better.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense, right? He's been able to pull off just an astonishing victory. Yeah. And of course, word would have spread. Did you hear what Gideon did? I mean, he took out all these many knights, and he never even raised his sword.
Well, dude, when George Washington defeats all the enemies, it's time to make him president.
Right.
This is how it goes, man.
This
right.
This is the way it needs to go.
When the United States were like, you know what, you know, the people of the New World are suddenly actually free, and they're like, who should we make our leader? Well, probably that general that got us all this freedom.
Yeah, I mean, don't we see this throughout the history of lots of different countries and cultures? Right, generals just quite naturally move up into leadership positions of the nation. Right? Yeah. They were successful militarily, so they'll also be successful in governing.
Yeah, well,
that's kind of what they're thinking, right?
Yeah, well, it adds to, I mean, baked into this person is the idea of security.
Yeah.
Because you're like, well, I mean, look what this guy just did.
Yeah.
Who better? Like, I'm going to feel great having this guy be in charge, because he just destroyed everybody that was oppressing us. So yeah, I don't want, like, who else are we going to choose?
I mean, it's not like we need presidential primaries or anything. Right?
No,
we don't need a list of candidates from two different parties. We got our guy right here. He's in front of us. Yeah. So that's what they say. These men, it says the men of Israel. We don't know. I mean, how many men of Israel, these, like, just from kind of the representatives of the people who were following him, or how far flung was this particular group? We're not told. It just says the men of Israel. They say to Gideon, yeah, rule over us, both you and your son's son, because you've delivered us from the hand of Midian. So, I mean, it, not only do we have them asking him to be king, they want a dynasty, right?
I was going to say, they're about to set up the monarchy right here, man.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they named three generations. First Gideon, you will. And then your son, and then your grandson. So they've got it all planned out. And you're right, they never say the word king, but the Hebrew word that's used there for rule is, of course, very frequently used of the function of kings. So it's clearly that's what they had in mind. And I don't know how they wouldn't have had that in mind, because, well, they just killed two kings, right? Everybody had kings except Israel. You had kings of city-states, you had kings of countries. Obviously, you had multiple kings, because you had just two kings mentioned there of Midian. So, I mean, a lot of the kings of the ancient world weren't like what we think of, if we think of like the king of England or the king of some country. I mean, they were kings, yeah, but they were kings of what we call city states, smaller areas, you know, probably would come call the day like a governor or mayor or something like that. But they were called the king. So that's what they want. Now, Gideon says one thing with his mouth, but he does something quite different with his hands, with his actions. So here's his response. And it sounds like a good response, right? And just on the surface, it is.
The first sentence sounds just like bang on, man.
Yeah. I mean, I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you.
Man, this dude is pious.
He is. He is pious. Yeah. And if he would have just shut up at that point, everything would have been good. I mean, if he just like stop talking and don't say anything else, you've just uttered truth. You have delivered an orthodox confession of faith. I am not king. God is king. Period. But he doesn't. After he gives this little speech, my verse 24 starts out with the word, single word, yet. I mean, which is kind of an interpretive translation, but it kind of gives you a hint as to what's about to happen. Yet, you know, Gideon says this, yet Gideon goes on to say, I would request of you that each of you give me an earring from his spoil. And then it has in parentheses, for they had gold earrings because they were Ishmaelites. And maybe the Ishmaelites were known for having gold earrings, evidently. So after they killed all these guys, as you know, as commonly happens in war, they would strip the fallen. They would take whatever they could use from the fallen warriors. So I guess they had a whole bunch of golden earrings that they had stripped from these slain Midianite warriors. And they said, oh, you bet, we will surely give them. So they spread out this cloak on the ground, and every one of them throws an earring onto the cloak from his spoil. Now let me pause there for a second, because I think I think we're getting set up here. There's a couple things I think that we should, if we put our ear right to the Bible and like listen real closely, there's a couple of whispers here. First of all, what story before this did we have golden earrings mentioned being collected by a leader in Israel to use for something?
It's just the first priest ever.
Yeah, just the first priest here. It just happens to be like the brother of like the biggest name in the Old Testament. Yeah, all the way back in Exodus, right? When Moses is up on the mountain and the people come to Aaron and say, make a God for us because we don't know what happened to this Moses. So what does Aaron do? He starts collecting earrings, right? Starts collecting those gold earrings. So I think that's one story that maybe not even whispered here. I think this is like a shout that we should hear, especially when we get to what's coming next. But the other story is not really a story. It's a verse earlier in this particular story. Remember that when the Spirit came upon Gideon, I made a point of noting that usually when the Spirit comes upon a person, it just says that the Spirit came upon that person. But we're told back in chapter 6, verse 34, that the Spirit of the Lord clothed Gideon. And I'm wondering if we're not supposed to kind of hear that as kind of a contrast to what's happening here. So the Spirit came upon Gideon as like a cloak comes upon a person. The Spirit is clothing Gideon earlier. And now as this story turns south, you have a cloak, you have clothing once more thrown down, but the Spirit is going to be completely uninvolved, indeed opposed to what's about to happen. So that's what goes on in verse 25. What are they going to do with all this gold? Well, let's find out. This is a bunch, right? Says the weight of the gold earrings was 1,700 shekels, which one commentator says was about 43 pounds worth of gold. Yeah, I wouldn't mind having 43 pounds of gold. I mean, that'd be pretty nice. I'd put that in my safety deposit box,
yeah.
keep for a rainy day. So, that's a lot. Keep in mind, by the way, that at this point, there was no coinage. This is before there were coins. So when you hear about like shekels, don't think in terms of coins. It just was a unit of weight is all. So A shekel was about, I don't know, like 4/10 of an ounce. I don't know, something like that. We're uncertain about the exact weight of that, but it was a small unit of measurement. Anyway, comes out to about 43 pounds. And that's beside, it says, the crescent ornaments, which we heard about earlier, and the pendants and the purple robes, which were on the kings of Midians, and the neck bands that are on their camels' necks. So there's a whole lot of wealth that they have from the spoils of war. So what's Gideon going to do with all this gold? Well, we find out in verse 27, that Gideon made it into an ephod and placed it in his city, Ophrah, and all Israel, as you might expect, played the harlot with it there, so that it became a snare to Gideon and his household. So, it's not good. We see Gideon. You think about this story as a whole, and what's the first thing God told Gideon to do? Right, to take his take an ox and to tear down the altar of his father and to cut down the Asherah pole and to sacrifice a bull there and to use the wood from the Asherah pole for the sacrifice. So the very first thing that God told Gideon to do was to destroy idolatry. And now, at this point in the story, once Gideon has achieved this great success, he turns right around and he not only engages in idolatry, but he makes an idolatrous object. And it's not just him, or just him and his family, or just him and his city that are negatively affected by this, but it says all Israel began to play the harlot with it there. As Gideon's name and his fame spread, his impact also spread. And so people, no doubt, were looking to him for leadership, for guidance. And this is what he did. He made this golden ephod. It's a little bit difficult to define because there's different kinds of ephods in the Old Testament. Usually we think of that connected with like the breastplate of the high priest. But there's other kinds of ephods which seem to like stand upright. So clearly not just an article of clothing. So ephod is a little bit difficult precisely to define, but we do know that it was often used. In fact, we're going to encounter one later in the book of Judges in idolatrous circumstances. And when it says Israel played the harlot there, well, it's pretty obvious what's going on there, that they were engaging once more in the worship of probably Baal, maybe Asherah as well. And all this became a snare to Gideon and to his household.
My translation is a little more explicit here, where it's, and all of Israel whored after it.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, there's like an adulterous sort of connotation to it, but there's also like when you hear that, like all like the entire nation whores after this thing, there's like this really sort of like dirty lust like that's built into that, right? Where it's where these other gods. It's so interesting that over and over and over again, what you see is that Israel, and this is true of us too, are easily seduced by sort of like a sexier god. Right, because Yahweh's just not that sexy.
Right, right.
He's using like ordinary things. He doesn't have images, like all this. It's just not as arousing to the senses. So yeah, this sort of hoard after it language, it has this sort of like, look, we have this lust for a god that is different than the god that we have.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect way to put it. I mean, and quite literally, the other gods were sexier.
Yeah.
I mean, because of course, sex was actually a part of their worship, and they were all about fertility. So you can see why, knowing people are the way they are, that this would have been a constant temptation for the Israelites. And I mean, the sad part of this whole story is that despite Gideon's great successes due to God's intervention, I mean, God set the whole thing up, right? He reduced his force to 300 men, so that it would be obvious that this was all a gift from God. And yet, Gideon is a typical case where it's easy to forget that it's easy to transform the gifts of God into entitlements or to personal achievements, and that's certainly what happened here with him.
Yeah, and still, this is sort of the end of the story. We'll get to the death of Gideon next week, but it's weird that it ends here, with the land had rest for 40 years in the days of Gideon. So it had it had rest in the sense that it wasn't being oppressed or enslaved by anyone. But during this 40 years of rest, what do you have? The not so slow decline into idolatry. So this one is set up a little bit differently because you have like, then they had 40 years of rest, but then they did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. This way, in this story, you get the patience of God, where this seems to have happened pretty quickly, and for 40 years, God is pretty patient, as the children of Israel don't have any enemies invading them or anything like this, but there is this idolatry going on, and you assume that this is how it usually works. It wasn't like there was 40 years of rest, and they were doing everything that they should do, and it was great, and then one day, one guy did one thing that really, really rubbed God the wrong way. No, this is how it works. It's like,
yeah,
they're delivered, and immediately the decline starts. And then for 40 years, God is long-suffering, and then he has enough.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great way to describe it. This is just more of a kind of a realistic portrait of exactly what was happening in Israel. They didn't like wake up one day and decide, you know what, I'm done with Yahweh. I'm going to worship Baal.
Right.
It was always a cancer that was growing in the nation until finally it was enough. And we're out of time.
That's it, man. Next week, we'll wrap up Gideon. Guys, if you enjoy the podcast and it's been helpful to you, you can support it by going over to 1517.org. Go to the donate page. You can become a monthly contributor there. Thank you so much to those of you who do that. Chad, I will see you next week.
See you then.